Representative Montgomery is absent for the day, and Representative Lehman is busy right now. But we're going to start with the...
I'm going to open
a hearing on House Bill 2569. This is Representative Byers' bill. Yeah, Janet, well, while you're getting your paperwork ready, we'll explain the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. House Bill 2569 would create the offense of operating a passenger vehicle without a litter bag and make that offense a Class B traffic infraction punishable by a maximum $75 fine. It would require the Department of Transportation to design, produce, and distribute 3 litter bags containing an anti-littering message along with information on the bag about fines for littering. Mr. Chair, at your place, you have a fiscal statement and the witnesses should show any fire in the constituent.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, members. If we can get everyone seated in the back of the room or take the conversations out in the hall, we'd appreciate it, and so we can hear a little better. Welcome, Representative Byer, and your guest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Roger Byer, State Representative, District 28. With me today is Ethan Huff, who's from Silverton, actually specifically the Drake crossing area by Silver Falls State Park. Ethan came to me with this idea, I think it was sometime in the last year. So I had this bill drafted at his request, and he has taken the day today, and I think the chairman for scheduling it, so he could come in and testify in support of the bill. I think I will let him speak to the bill and to the reasons behind the bill, and then if we have any questions, we'd be happy to try to answer them. So with that, Ethan.
Nice to have you here today, Ethan.
Thank you. The first thing I'd like to say is, why I came up with...
I'm going to pull that mic up a little closer.
I'm Ethan.
Stick right into it.
I'm Ethan Huff. And the reason I came up with this bill was because of one of my friends, 1950. Now, up in the Drake crossing place, they have been cleaning up and throwing away all the garbage that other people have been cleaning up. And I don't think that's fair. Sure. Other people throw out away their stuff, and they have to pick it up. I don't think that's very fair. And I just came up with this because my family does it. We do it because we like nature, not dirty ponds. And together, me, my friends, you, and nature, we can all make the world a better place, especially Oregon.
I think we really agree with those statements. Do you work along with your friends along the highway picking up litter, or you've ever been involved in any of those type of projects?
No, we've wanted to, but we won't.
Where do you think most people throw their junk out at?
Probably around the country and coming into Salem, because I see a bunch.
Along the highway?
Yeah.
Yes. What do you think we ought to do about this issue, Representative Byer?
Well, Mr. Chair, I will have to leave that up to the wisdom of this committee. I know you have been dealing with transportation issues all session, and I have not had the fortune to serve on the committee dealing with those issues, so I'll leave that up to your good judgment.
Well, it's nice to have you in front of this austere committee, even though we're short two people here this morning. Austere.
there.
I think this is a great idea. I think, really, Ethan, we're going to have to think about this a little bit. It takes us a while to kind of come up with, make a decision. This is a big decision on a bill like this. This would require litter bags in every passenger motor vehicle. It requires the Department of Transportation to design and distribute those litter bags. and imposes a fine, and so we're going to need to discuss this a little bit with the Department of Transportation and see if they have anyone that can design those bags. And so we're not going to be able to make a decision on that right now. Is that all right? Yeah, well, thank you for
coming. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Yeah, thank you. With that, close the hearing on House Bill 2569. Well, that will open a work session on 2199, and while we're getting our paperwork organized, Janet will tell us the history of this issue here.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2199 is an increase in the aviation fuel tax and the jet fuel tax to fund pavement management and pavement preservation programs at public use airports. The hearing was held on this bill April 16th. There were a number of questions that the committee had, and Ann Cook at your place was a response letter to those questions from Ann Cook, Interim Manager for Aeronautics Division. This measure does have a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee, and the committee did discuss, although we weren't in work session and nothing was adopted, the committee did discuss the amendments that are at your place, the -2 amendments, and those amendments would allow use of the new revenue, not existing revenue from the existing 3 cents, but the new revenue from the 6 cent phased-in increase to go to privately owned as well as publicly owned public use airport pavement maintenance. There are representatives from the Aeronautics Division here. If you have any questions about that particular amendment or about any parts of the bill, we had to kind of cut the hearing short, so there may be additional questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. As you remember, this issue, part of the controversy in this issue deals with just the disbursement of the funds and how those are determined, realizing that a large amount of the money does come from jet fuel. I believe that's right, jet fuel, and that's sold at Portland Airport. And so then those funds then are then distributed, not necessarily where they arrived at, but out to all the other airports. I think we'd like to have a little discussion on this issue of private versus public and whether it would be the right thing to do to distribute these funds to privately held airports. I'd like to hear a little more about that. Who's going to talk about that? And let's come up. I have personally a little bit of concern about that. We need to have some assurance if we were to go that route when we're taking public gas taxes, in a sense, public taxes, and giving it to private property owners.
For the record, my name is Ann Cook. I'm the Interim Manager of the Aeronautics Division of the Department of Transportation. It says in the bill that the funds will be dispersed for this program on a formula to be determined by the aviation plan, which is in development right now. That aviation plan advisory committee has discussed the issue of the privately owned public use airports, and they did realize that these airports, even though they're privately owned, are public use, and there are 15 of those in the state. And so since they're open to the public, maybe they are deserving of some public funds. As a matter of fact, there are two of those 15 that are eligible to receive federal funding. When they receive a federal grant, they sign grant assurances that requires them to maintain the airport as a public use airport for 20 years. The current policy developed in the aviation plan didn't recommend including these privately owned public use airports because of the concern that the privately owned, they could be closed at any time and there goes public investment. Though I don't think anyone would have a problem with that if we wrote the rules around this resulting legislation to require a similar grant assurance to what the federal government does, that the airport will be open to the public for a minimum of 20 years so that the public investment isn't lost.
And how can you guarantee that when they're privately owned, private property, that they would be open in them for 20 years?
Chair Wells, if we had a grand assurance that they signed when we gave them the project, then that would be our assurance. And if they decided to close it anyway, then we would require the money back. And that's what the federal government does.
Mm-hmm. We have Michael Van Humessen signed up. You stay there, Ann. And you'd like to come on up and go ahead. This is a work session. I invited testimony, so we're interested in hearing what you have to say. You're from the Oregon Aviation Alliance. Maybe tell us who that is.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Representative Wells. My name is Mike Van Humessen. I'm from Lake Oswego, Oregon. I am the president of the Oregon Aviation Alliance. We are a group of users of the Oregon aviation system. We are comprised of groups such as the Oregon Pilots Association and also the Experimental Aircraft Association. Those are pilot groups. We also represent the Oregon Airport managers. They sit at our table. The aviation division has a seat at the meeting. We also have Port of Portland there, and we have the Agricultural Flying Farmers Association, those groups. We essentially have all the alphabet, significant alphabet groups around the state of Oregon that use the Oregon aviation system. We represent some 8,000 pilots. I'm a pilot and an instructor pilot in gliders. Now, our group supports House Bill 2199. And if you accept the premise that the 100 public use Oregon airports, their pavements, meaning their taxiways and runways, are in fair and deteriorating condition, and that situation should be corrected, then there must be a solution to that. Recognizing this, the Oregon Aviation Alliance last year asked Grace Krenigan, as chair of ODOT, to assemble a group to discuss this in hopes that we might come to some agreement among the alphabet users and ODOT to formulate some legislation to remedy the situation. The fix to that problem is what you have before you, House Bill 2199. I understand that you've been briefed on the particulars of that at the last hearing, and I won't review those at this time. Let me make a few broad comments and observations that we as the Alliance and the users of the system have. In the bill, you've got a rather significant increase in aviation gas tax, some 6% over the next two fiscal years. I'm sorry, 6 cents, a total of 9 cents, to the basically general aviation population. I personally fly in that population as I operate reciprocating aircraft and not jet aircraft. In fact, that increase takes Oregon up from being 44th among the 50 states to 19th in the batting order of size of avgas tax. Not to belittle the jet fuel increase of a half cent to 1 cent, but in comparison to our 50 states, that still leaves us where we are now on jet fuel tax across 50 states at 44th. This significant increase in revenues that will come to the aviation division to manage will make a significant, I think, significant impact on the maintenance of our pavement programs. Now, let me say that the pilots around the state gave this some careful consideration, and they don't relish the idea of having to pay an additional 6 cents over the 2 years. But they were willing to accept that fact If they were willing, if they were able to get a guarantee that this money would be used for pavement that they could taxi and land on. And that's why it's significant for us all to realize here that what we're doing is dedicating this to a pavement maintenance program, which is already in existence in the Aeronautics Division, and that it would not be used for administration and staff. This, we think, is a reasonable price to pay. Each general aviation there is making a significant contribution increase tax to them, as is the commercial aviation and jet fuel folks. We also, yes, sir.
Michael, do you have any idea, any ideas on this privately owned airport distribution?
That's my next point.
Okay, great. We need to kind of move along so maybe we can kind of get to that. That issue there is kind of, I think, the thing we're trying to wrestle with here this morning.
Let me just cut to it and say that we would support what I understand as an amendment to delete the term publicly owned from the bill, and here's why. The privately owned public use, and that's what's key here. These are public use airports. They happen to be privately owned, but the public uses them and uses the ones that would get the money, I would say, under the priorities that it could be set, uses them quite heavily. Therefore, they are a significant benefit to the public. And because they are public use, they should be entitled to play and compete for those funds. Let me just conclude to say that this bill is a very good compromise solution agreement among all of the users of the system, and it's necessary to get these funds in place if we're going to preserve these airports for our children and grandchildren. Thank you.
Is there any questions from the committee? I think with that, moving along here with our agenda today, we heard good testimony last week on the issue and the need. We had a suggestion here that came up out of this in the disbursement issue of dispersing these funds to not only public-owned but private-owned, and we have a proposed amendment on page 3 of the bill, deadline 23, that would take out the word publicly-owned. So we were kind of, again, addressing this issue. We have a Bill Jackson that would like to yeah, come on up, Bill. I kind of want to get moving on this issue, but if you have a short comment, we'd be interested in it. Maybe more to the issue of the public versus private owned issue.
Okay.
My
name's Bill Jackson. I live on Sunset Airstrip up by North Plains, Oregon. It's a privately owned, private use grass strip, and so we don't have any interest, of course, in pavement. I also fly a float plane, so again, I don't have any interest in pavement. But it seems like one of the concerns is the guarantee that the airports would stay open. And said the FAA has a guarantee, and when they release their grants, and it would seem to me that if we had that same guarantee, the FAA does a pretty good job of covering their I's and crossing their T's. One thing that we need to remember is that these privately owned airports pay property tax, and they contribute to the revenue of the state. And I think that's a factor that needs to be considered.
That's true. There's a little different revenue stream. That money goes to support the fire and the schools and that sort of thing, where this is a fee that really covers the of course, building airports and maintaining them, so it's a little different revenue stream, but you are right. I think with that, Representative Cumlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. One for Bill. With a privately owned aircraft or airport, do you dispense your own fuel on site?
No. Ours is a residential airpark, and we don't have any commercial operations of any kind on our residential airport.
follow up on this. So how do you get fuel? And I use like fly over to Hillsborough or something whenever you need fuel. And
we go over to Hillsborough. Hillsborough gets pretty busy at times, and so then we go to places like Stark's Twin Oaks or Sportsman at Newburgh, the smaller airports where there isn't a lot of congestion like you get at Portland or Hillsborough at times.
Okay. Okay, thank you. And then one more question, Mr.
Yes, Mr. Everett.
Thank you. And a question for you with regards to the memo that we have here that lists the questions that were asked and your response.
Mm-hmm.
On the allocation plan, it says the proposed program does not allocate funds to specific airports or types. But in a February 23rd memorandum, there's a listing of projects. Are these projects that have been identified by the commission or by the aeronautics committee that these are projects they would like to work on, and these are the costs that they're anticipating, or are these grants, or where are they?
I can tell you. Chair Wells, Representative Krummel. That is the beginning, starting from project list that is a result of our ongoing computer program that's already funded by the FAA that tells us what the needs are for pavement maintenance in the state. The advisory, the Aviation Plan Advisory Committee is continuing to develop some policy that will make that, will tear that list down a little bit and make it make more sense. For example, you'll see that some of the projects listed in that list might be for $5. It wouldn't make any sense to do a $5 project at an airport. So we're putting together the process to group projects in an efficient way. But that is the starting baseline.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilson.
Since you're talking about cost, I have a letter here that, from a gentleman, and he said that he has been informed that Aeronautics plans to hire a professional general aviation consultant to review bare land lease terms, lease renewals, and fees for these uses. What is that about? Why would you have to have a consultant? Isn't that something that you would be able to do under your job description?
I'm sure, well, Representative Loken, managing airports is something that I do under my job description, yes. However, with 31 airports, which are the state-owned ones, and lease issues that run from appraising property to determining fair market lease values and fair terms of lease is something that is quite commonly contracted out for a couple of reasons. First, to get an expert in airport appraisals, which an airport manager isn't necessarily that broad of an expert, and to have a third party, disinterested opinion of what a fair market value is, rather than having me telling somebody you're going to pay this and having that sort of dispute.
Yes, Representative Wilson.
Just an idea of the cost.
Yeah, Chair Wells, Representative Loken, we are estimating between $20,000 and $30,000 for that project.
Mm-hmm. And one more follow-up.
Yes, Representative Wilson.
And is that competitively bid? How do you arrive that that is a fair sound too high?
Well, Chair Wells, Representative Loken, actually that's our estimate. We haven't hired anyone yet. We will do a competitive bid process, and yes, hopefully we'll come in under that.
Mm-hmm.
So members, moving along here, Janet, I think as I understand this bill, we have an increase to 6 cents when the bill goes to effect, and on July 1, it goes to 9 cents.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
So if you notice your bill on the second page, section 3, it's a phase in on July 1, 2000, where it goes to 9 cents. That's the same language we have on the front page showing going from 3 to 6 cents. And then on the third page, it shows in a refund on fuel that's where they paid the full 24 cents. I understand that's 24 cents, and then there's a 9. Withhold the 9 cents.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that section 2 and section 4 are motor vehicle fuel, not aviation. They do pay the full 24 cents, are entitled to a refund of all but the 3 cents now, which would go to 6 and 9 cents. But most of the revenue from motor vehicle fuel, or what's also called MoGas, is from unclaimed refunds, because most people don't claim the refunds from 21 cents. So that's the most of the revenue comes from motor vehicle fuel gas or MoGas.
Well, I think first we need to discuss the Dash 2 amendments. I understand we have some Dash 3 from Representative Lewis, who are the same exact same wording. The Dash 2 came from Representative Crump.
That's correct.
Do we have, we're in a work session, do we have any discussion or a motion on this issue on allocation of the funds to privately owned, only public owned?
Clarification, Mr. Chair.
So
Dash 3s are exactly like the Dash 2s?
As I understand.
I don't. Do we have a Dash 3?
Well, Janet showed them to me here.
Mr. Chair, we just have 2 copies of the Dash 3s. Excuse me. We just got them this morning. They're identical to the Dash 3s.
Oh, okay.
And they were brought by Representative Lewis's office.
Sure. If I understand it correctly, if we do this, what we're basically saying is you have a privately owned airport, and then we can use these dollars we raise from the aviation tax to do the pavement. The pavement, is that a correct conclusion?
Representative Lehman, if privately owned, publicly used airport, I have a privately owned, privately used airport, and I would not be available, and it would not be my intention to be able to have access to anyone's funds. I don't need it. I don't want them. But there are many privately owned public use airports that have needs also. And I think it's appropriate that if those pilots are paying into the fuel tax system, that they should have some of that money allocated to be available to them.
Sure. The concern I've got is, and I'm trying to think of an analogy, is that if you built a subdivision and built your own streets into that subdivision, and you charge people a fee for living in that subdivision, you would not have the owner of that those streets come back and say, those are publicly used streets, because people come and go as they want. So we're going to have tax, gas tax dollars pave those streets. I'm having trouble with making this conclusion. I understand the public uses these airports, but they're still private. We're using public tax dollars to support a private enterprise.
If I may respond to the subdivision analogy, generally speaking, in that kind of an analogy, two things occur. Number one is that, at least in Oregon, if the developer of the subdivision wants to be able to get traffic to the subdivision, they pay an SDC charge, a systems development charge, for the increased capacity on the collector streets outside the subdivision. Second thing is that generally occurs is that when a subdivision is constructed, is that the streets are then dedicated to the public. In other words, they are given to the city and or to the county or whoever the owner is, and then at that point in time, the jurisdiction takes over all maintenance of those.
Some of you mentioned the point. I mean, there are some instances where those streets are maintained by the ownership of the planned unit development or whatever. And I understand all the other issues. Once they're public, that's a different issue. But if they're still privately owned streets used by the public, a commercial setting may be a better example. Do we want to use gas tax dollars to maintain those streets, even if they're privately owned, for public use? And that's the dividing line I have difficulty with.
That's a good point.
We have some testimony on this. Evidently, the federal aviation people, they do disperse some funds in this type of a situation, the privately owned, publicly used.
Sure, well, yes, it is.
And they do it under a type of assurance system that they're going to continue to stay open.
Yes, they do. Chair Wells, may I add a comment
mm-hmm.
about that, too? Several people at the last hearing had some questions about how the funds would be allocated and if it would be based on levels of airports or, you know, if CDX would get a certain amount. And this program that we've put together, the very first thing that it does is prioritizes the airports based on their importance to the system.
And so we've got that prioritization already done, and it includes the privately owned public use airports. So it doesn't mean that we would be funding airports that get very little use beyond the private users that are at that airport. They would still be prioritized based on their importance to the statewide system, the same as all of the publicly owned airports.
Representative Devlin, did you have some input on this?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to say that I'm not as concerned about the issue because basically these are not, other than the reports on the airline level are being passed on to the general public, but on the general aviation level, there are fees that are being paid by the users of the airports, and there seems to be acceptance by the users of the airports, and plus I think there's probably significant public benefits to that, being that there are a limited number of public airports, both in terms of not a pilot, but in terms of safety of having other airports available and having them in reasonable quality. As one pilot approached me yesterday on this bill, who's just a single engine pilot, but his aircraft still costs is valued at about $30,000 or $35,000, he would much rather pay a little bit extra in gas tax than hit a pothole on an airline costing thousands of dollars or more in repairs. And so I think the people that are paying the fee are okay with this, and if they're okay with this, I'm fine with it all.
Would Representative Krupp, what would you like to do with your amendment?
Well, I would move the dash one amendment into the
dash two.
Excuse me, dash two. I apologize.
We have a motion to move the dash two. Any more discussion? I'd call the roll on this.
Representative Krupp. Aye. Representative Krupp. Aye. Representative Krupp. Aye. Representative Lincoln. Aye. Representative Taylor. Aye. Representative Walker. Aye. Representative Walker. Aye. With that, we've adopted the dash two. So now we have the bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2199 to House Revenue.
As
amended?
With.
You're going to do pass.
You're going to have to wait. With a due pass, but now we don't need to do that. You can send it without the due pass.
I'd like to make the statement.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any discussion on the motion? Representative Cromwell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. They say that the best tax is the tax that somebody else pays. So I guess in that respect, I can support this. But I've gotten a lot of letters. But the one letter that really kind of stuck out to me is one where the person says, "I hate taxes like the devil hates holy water." But I feel that this increase in fuel taxes, a person over 20 years, is needed to maintain our deteriorating airports. And I think it's a point well taken. I don't like increasing our taxes either. And I'm a little bit concerned about what happens to this once it gets over to the Senate side, if it gets over to the Senate side. But I will support the bill.
Mr. Chair?
Thank you. I also echo the gentleman's sentiment. I don't care at all for raising taxes. However, I'm a believer in user pays, and as a pilot, I also recognize the need and the condition of Oregon's airports because I fly in and out of them all over the state all the time. And not only paved airports, but some unimproved airports, one that I fly through regularly is Wacona Beach out of Walport, which is a grass airstrip, no lights, no nothing. But I'm glad it's there. And I'd like to see, obviously, the state be able to address continued needs if those airports are improved also. I'm in favor of doing this, even though I don't like raising taxes on myself. I'm a user of this system, and I am willing to pay more to maintain that system and the safety of it, and the fact that I don't have to punch holes in my airplane or blow off a landing gear on landing at takeoff because I hit a pothole and get killed or muck up my airplane. So I'm certainly in favor of it, Mr. Chairman.
With that, would you like to call the roll, please?
Aye.
Representative Krupp. Aye.
Representative Krupp. Aye.
Representative Lincoln.
Aye.
Representative Lincoln.
Aye.
Representative
Taylor. Aye.
Representative
Walker. Aye.
Representative
Wells.
Yes. House Bill 2199 is moved to revenue with a due pass. With that, I'll turn it back over to Vice Chairman Lehman. He's got his running around done and ready to go to work.
Thank you, Assistant Vice Chairman. let's go through a couple of housekeeping things we can do. House Bill 2348 is not going to be heard. The sponsor of that committee has decided to pull that bill, and I assume the people signed up are comfortable with that and happy to have that one go away.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry that went away. I had a real great amendment to it, to have your headlights on all hours.
That probably would have got even more people up here.
Yeah.
What I'm going to do real quickly is open a work session on House Bill 2003. Does anybody have any desire to move this bill? If not, I'll close the work session in 2003. That's the website license.
Mr. Chairman, due to an obligation I have made, I will move.
Before you move, who do you need to obligate? I think it's from the speaker's office that I talked to. They just want that to quietly go. Do you have any other obligation to do anything?
Not beyond that.
Yes. Open up. Close the work session on 2000. I wouldn't say that. Just we're not taking the action on today.
Okay.
Open a work session. Close the work session on 2003, and we'll open a work session on 2189.
Already on.
Open a work.
Yeah.
Public hearing. Excuse me. Close the work session for public hearing on 2189.
Not at the action chair.
Get it? You want to explain this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2189 is at the request of the Department of Transportation, and the original bill would allow audits of motor carrier tax reports to be the basis of refunds or assessments of additional tax beyond 3 years, which is the current limit in statute, if the audit was begun within 3 years. The second thing the bill does is make officers and employees of corporations or partnerships who are responsible for exercising the duties of the corporation or partnership and who fail to pay motor carrier taxes personally liable for payments of the taxes. The problem is that the Department of Transportation in the second instance is unable to collect taxes from people who set up corporations, go out of business, and subsequently place their assets outside of the corporate name. And according to the department, the original bill was intended to only hold key employees liable, not those who are responsible for payment, not any mid-level employees. We do have at your place this morning -1 amendment that deletes the personal liability provision, which is at the end of the bill. And the department can explain another provision of the bill that I did not explain. The other thing the -1 amendments do is specify that the extension of the audit beyond 3 years would only be authorized in cases where the audit had begun within the 3 years, but the person being audited failed to provide the requested records in the time specified by the department. So it shouldn't just be a starting audit at toward the end of the 3 years and have it carried on by the department. You have a fiscal statement at your place. I want you to note that if for the original bill, not the -1 amendment, and you can see that there's a substantial amount of revenue, weight mile tax revenue, that would be available from the corporate liability provision, the personal liability provision. But that, again, is for the original bill, and the department will be able to tell us how the -1 amendment affects fiscal. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And the -1s were submitted by the department?
Actually, Mr. Chair, the -1s, I think, were worked on with the department and the trucking industry.
With that, Dave Power and Bob Attell.
The Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dave Tyler. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for ODOT. We are here in support of House Bill 2189. With me is Bob Otley, who is the Motor Carrier Audit Manager. As you just heard from Ms. Atkins, we are comfortable with the elimination of Section 10, the personal liability part of House Bill 2189. So we'd very much like your approval of the remaining two parts of the bill, which Mr. Otley will address now.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Basically, what the bill that you have before you does is locks the audit period that is covered in a weight mile tax audit, and secondly, it permits staff to consolidate multiple reporting periods when calculating penalty charges. Today, when an audit is billed, the audit cannot include tax reports that were filed more than 3 years prior to the billing date. This bill would allow the audit period to be locked once the person being audited or his representative has been notified that the audit has begun and that records have been requested. Then, if the person being audited or his representative failed to produce the records in a timely manner as defined by the department or as requested by the department, the reporting periods or would not be lost to the statute when the audit is ultimately billed. I'd like to point out that this this change in the statute would create consistency between the weight mile tax audits that we do today and the international fuel tax agreement for which we also do audits. We understand the ramifications of House Bill 3344 dealing with weight mile taxes, but even if that bill were to pass, we would still have responsibility to audit for 3 years, so this change would keep us consistent or make us consistent with the audit. The second part of the bill would also create consistency with the International Fuel Tax Agreement relative to penalty charges on final cumulative audit results. Currently, the adjusted tax for each reporting period, which is generally a monthly or a quarterly time period, is compared to the reported fees for that same period. Penalties are then assessed on a sliding scale based on the relationship of the reported tax and the adjusted tax. If a credit currently exists in any one period, it has no effect on penalty assessments for other periods because today, as I indicated, it's compared on a period-by-period basis. Passage of this bill would allow the credit adjustment in a monthly or a quarterly period to have an impact on the overall penalty assessment because the comparison of the reported tax and final tax would be on the bottom line. This would benefit the person being audited. As you've been told, the bill has been amended in a couple of ways. Both of these changes are in response to industry's concerns. The first change deals with the statute of limitations issue, and the amendment basically clarifies that the audit period would only be locked if the person or their representative, the person being audited or their representative, failed to provide the records to staff in the timeline identified by the department. The second change, as indicated, does repeal or delete the reference to the corporate officers being personally liable.
Deletion of the corporate officer liability, and I assume that's something you've worked out with the trucking industry as a means, is that a big problem in terms of collecting weight mile taxes when you have a corporation or partnership that's able to evade or not pay the taxes because without this liability?
Mr. Chair, I would defer to Mr. Tyler for that response.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there have been significant problems over the years with this. Entities being formed with two or three corporate officers, family members, and then the corporation's going defunct, leaving significant balances due and payable to state, forming a new corporate structure with slightly different officer composition. I don't believe in the last 3 to 5 years the problem has been as severe as it was in the early 90s, but it is still a problem.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Bishop?
Is this not concept in paragraph 10 of the original bill, lines 20 through 23? Is that not currently what we do on the federal level in terms of payroll taxes? Corporate officers are liable for payroll taxes to the federal government. So this is not a new concept.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, that's correct. The distinction is the fact that payroll taxes and employment taxes are held in trust by the employer before those funds are passed on to the state. In this case, they are not. These are not trust funds, if you will. When you look at House Bill 3344, the same provision exists in that proposed legislation because the funds are being held by the suppliers in trust before they're passed to the state. So there are some subtle but albeit major differences.
Mr. Schott, are you done or are you a few more?
Mr. Chair, I have finished, yes. Thank you.
Any other questions, Mr. Gentleman? Do you have something else?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just a slight comment concerning the fiscal on this. Because of the elimination of Section 10, as Mr. Otley indicated, what we have is a situation where anticipated revenues are negatively impacted by a very minor amount, less than $20,000. There is no added cost to the department for the bill as amended.
So looking at the fiscal, the original bill shows a revenue increase of $336,000 in the first biennium. So you say that goes down $20,000, or it goes down zero and then $20,000 below that?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. There is no added revenues realized when you take out the corporate officer liability.
The expenditure level stays the same?
The expenditures are gone. There is no added cost to the department for the bill as amended.
Let me understand. If we pass the bill in its original version, we net something like $250,000 more to the Highway Trust Fund. If we change it with the amendments, we end up cutting a couple of thousand dollars net.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Mr. Chair,
what do you want to say?
With these amendments, do we really gut the teeth of this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, I don't believe we do. I think the other two components are very important, and if you will, they're customer service issues to allow us to better serve industry and to make the penalty calculations clearer for the motor carriers to understand. The scoff law issue has been around for many, many years, and it's a nice to have, and it would generate some incremental revenues and send a message to the bad part of the industry, which is a very small component of the motor carrier industry. I really want to stress that, but it is an issue.
Well, Mr. Chair, follow-up, I thought I just heard you say a moment ago that because there are abilities of certain corporate officers to change the entity or liability by changing entities and so on and so forth, I thought I heard you say that was significant. It would seem to me that if that's significant in your estimation based on your earlier testimony, that this ought to be an important issue.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, it was a larger issue in the early 90s and the 80s. There had been a pattern of what I would call abuse. I do not believe that same pattern exists in the last 5 to 7 years, but we are still having some problems with it.
Okay. Thank you.
Greg Walker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've mentioned that twice now, that there was a pattern of abuse. What's changed?
Why do you not have that same pattern? Did you start enforcing things, or what did you do?
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, I think with the assistance of Mr. Del Ponte and the Motor Carrier Transportation Division, we have done a better job of screening registrations and applications for authorities on the road so that we could identify potential crossovers of corporate officers and raise issues before credentials were issued. I think that's helped significantly.
And can you continue to do that? Because I have concerns here, too, that we don't have any personal liability with corporations. I've seen that before. I work in bankruptcy court as a court reporter, and I see that a lot. And I don't really think they should be getting off the hook here. So, I need to know what assurances I have that if you pass this bill, you're going to continue to clean that up.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, we will do the very best we can to clean it up and continue to identify potential conflicts within the officer structure and with Motor Carrier Transportation Division's assistance, denying credentials when we think we can. We're not going to relax that enforcement tool that we do have.
Can I, the trucking industry does not, they don't support this. They support the dash horns because they don't want the corporate liability. Do you know why? I mean,
they're going to be up here soon.
Are they going to be safe? I would like to ask that question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to ask one clarifying question, and that is with regards to the statement that this benefit occurs because of the difference between total Otley and your testimony. Mr. Otley, the benefit occurs because of the difference between total audited and total reported fees. So are you saying that the change that you're wanting to make in the audit procedures and the, not in the procedures, but in the timing and everything that Bill does, are you saying that that's going to benefit the customers that you're serving more, or is that going to benefit the department more, or who gets the benefit, I guess?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kremel, it is the person being audited, in this case the motor carrier, that would receive the benefit by virtue of a credit existing during the course of an audit and being netted out onto the bottom line. The adjusted tax would be lower, and then when compared to their total tax reported for the overall time period, the entire audit time period, it would have an effect of lowering the penalty assessment.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen. One quick question, and then you indicated that the problem of the liability is going down, but the numbers that you have here in terms of revenue are accurate, if in fact you put the personal liability on?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's the best estimate we have at this time, and frankly, it's a little reduced from the estimates we had during the last legislative session when we brought forth the same proposal.
If I'm understanding correctly, if we look back 10 years, those numbers would have been even higher.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Is there a question?
I guess I had a question, but maybe, I'm sorry, I had to be out. On the, the fiscal analysis, estimates additional collections of between $200,000 and $500,000 on penalties. Is that what we're talking about there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Logan, that was based on the revenues that we were forecasting were we able to go after corporate officers at the personal level.
Oh, I see.
Again, Mr. Chair, if I might, a very quick explanation of how the penalty process works. It's very simplistic. If you had 3 months under audit, and in two of the months, a carrier owed $100 of additional tax. In the third month, they had overpaid by $100. Under present law, the penalty assessment would be based on $200. The credit would have no impact. This proposal would assess the penalty on $100, the net, the bottom line for the entire audit period.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bob Russell and Bob McCullough.
Mm-hmm.
morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Russell. I'm Director of Government Affairs for the Oregon Trucking Association. We were not aware of the Dash 1 amendments until this morning, but we very much appreciate the department addressing our concerns with this particular bill. Its original form, we had a couple of problems. The first one was the reporting of the audit period. Basically, the way this bill is worded, there would no longer be any statute of limitations. The department conducted several different types of audits, and theoretically they could conduct an audit in their offices. They could open up our files and say they started an audit unbeknownst to us, which would essentially waive the statute of limitations. So that was a problem. With the Dash 1 amendments, where people that refuse to provide records to the department, the statute of limitations is waived. That's fine with us. We're happy with that. The second part was the portion dealing with the personal liability, not only for corporate officers, but also for employees. The way the bill's worded, it extends way down into the organization. I understand that the department has testified that their intent was not to prosecute mid-level employees, but certainly the way this bill is worded, they would be able to do that. I guess the point that I would also like to make is, and this bill illustrates one of the significant problems with the current weight mile tax. The department wouldn't be requesting this bill if we had a diesel fuel tax. And the problem is that with the weight mile tax, you're paying the taxes after the tax.
Russell, we're starting on a typically slope here. And let me see if I can make sense of this. And I know that, you know, we know that consistency is not a big issue with you sometimes, but let's try this out. One of the things I have heard you say,
moralizing there, sir.
What I've heard you say repeatedly is one of the issues with the weight mile tax is evasion, correct?
Mr. Chair, absolutely correct.
And evasion is when you use the roads and highways and as a trucking company or a trucker and do not pay for the use of that road or highway.
Sure, that's absolutely correct.
This is an example whereby a corporate structure is formed, trucks are run, roads and highways are used, and then they evade paying that by some corporate shell game. Correct?
Chairman, that's correct.
And if by chance we maintain the weight mile system, then this is a way of reducing evasion.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. What I was pointing out is that this is one of the flaws in the weight mile system. Because the tax is paid on the honor system, it's reported and paid after the fact. In essence, the Department of Transportation has accounts receivable from those people that don't pay the tax. With a diesel fuel tax, that doesn't occur. And because the diesel fuel tax is paid at the pump, before the truck even operates. So the liability is discharged before the motor carrier operates in the state. That was the point that I was trying to make, is that the diesel fuel tax doesn't suffer from this same problem.
What about registration fees?
Pardon?
What about registration fees?
Mr. Chair, the registration fees are exactly the same as diesel fuel taxes. They're paid up front before the carrier operates in the state. And therefore, they don't suffer from the same problem. Moving to the diesel fuel tax would significantly reduce the department's accounts receivable and would address this problem 100%.
Mr. Keller?
My name is Bob McKellar. I represent the Oregon Forest Products Transportation Association. To save the committee time, we came up together. I have essentially nothing more to offer, with one exception that we, any of us in the trucking business, do not like and suffer from any company that, for whatever purpose, and we can certainly name some in the last 10 years, who by any way avoid paying the taxes that they owe. This particular, the measure, the original measure, it extends down to employees and so on, and that we believe is not appropriate. Our association is here to ask you to support this measure with the Dash 1 amendment.
Any questions?
I have a question.
Sure, come on.
Sure. If it was worded in a way, and I'm going to subsection 10 on page 2, if it was worded in such a way that it didn't reach into the employees, but only affected the officers or the members of the partnership, would your objections to subsection 10 go away?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, not entirely. In many instances, we have trucking companies operating in this state that are very large. And the corporate officers and directors are not necessarily aware of what the employees are doing. So basically, you're imposing a liability on them, which they may or may not have the ability to control, or at least without knowledge. If we did something where we extended it down to officers and directors where they had knowledge that they were intentionally avoiding or evading the tax, I don't think we'd have any problem with that. But we want to give them the opportunity at least to have some control before they have the liability.
With all due respect, anytime I've been in charge of whatever kind of an organization it is, irrespective of what occurs below me, I take full responsibility for the actions of the employees of that organization. When I was mayor of Wilsonville, I took full responsibility for anything that occurred in the city. When I now as a legislator, actually I expect the governor to take full responsibility for anything that occurs underneath it. That may sound a little bit extreme, but it's absolutely true. And that's one of the problems that we start running into is passing the damn buck. I think, Harry Truman said it best, the buck stops here. Well, somebody in the corporation, and I don't care if they're in Minneapolis, they need to say, the buck stops here.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, in virtually or most instances, I would be in total agreement with you. And the problem that we have here is the complexity of the weight mile tax, and in essence, the inability of the motor carrier, irrespective of its intentions, to pay the tax accurately. We have a motor carrier right now that I'm working with, for example, that has been operating in this state for a number of years. It's one of the oldest companies in this state, and it is domiciled right here. And they have made every attempt in good faith to pay their weight distance tax accurately and on time. Through some misunderstanding in communication between the department and this company, they did not pay their taxes correctly. And they ended up with a $300,000 fine. That's part of our issue, is the tax itself is so complicated that it is very difficult to comply with. And we're now making corporate officers, employees, personally liable for a system that is broken. It doesn't work. If we had a simple, reasonable tax that people could understand and can comply with, I have a problem with what you're saying. But with the current weight mile system, with its complexity and the inability for people to pay it accurately, irrespective of their intentions, that gives us a problem.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Crook.
Bob, if we change weight mile, as the proposal is currently, how will this bill affect, will this bill still be valid? Will it still be needed to have audits? Will it still be needed to have corporate officers be held liable for evasion knowingly?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crump, it won't be necessary because the taxes will be paid up front. As Mr. Otley pointed out, once 3344 goes into effect, they're still going to have to audit for the weight mile tax for 3 years. So there are some provisions in this bill that would remain after you amend it with the Dash 1 that would still be useful and valid. We totally support any motor carrier that refuses to cooperate with the Department of Transportation. that we extend the audit period. However, I mean, that's perfectly okay. We also support the recalculation of the penalty. It simplifies the system from the auditor's point of view, and then it's beneficial for us.
All right.
Any other questions? One question. If, in fact, he enacted the fuel tax, and we're a few cents higher than Washington, and I go buy a load of diesel in Washington and then drive extensively in Oregon, mm-hmm. when I do the accounting system, I'm going to end up writing a check to Oregon for the miles I drove in excess of what I paid for the fuel tax in Washington, correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Well, again, if I formed a shell of a corporation, I could again evade those taxes without personal liability if I was able to set the corporation up to do that.
And Mr. Chairman, that is correct. However, the difference is you're going to pay a substantial portion of the tax in Washington, so the remainder is minimal. There is not going to be that much liability, because you're already going to have paid the diesel fuel tax.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Anybody else want to testify? We will close the work session on 2359, or close the public hearing on 2359, open the work session on 2359.
Mr. Chair,
2189.
Whatever.
2189.
We can
test
20.
Open the work
session
2189.
I don't know what it is.
Mr. Chair.
Jose
Crumble. I got to thinking about this as the last two gentlemen were talking, and with the questions that Representative Scrupp had been asking. And if we took a look at Section 10, as opposed to deleting the whole thing, I think that if we were to eliminate, or you know, I'm not sure that we want to necessarily throw the baby out with the bathwater on this. And I think that sort of was the department's response to the objections of the trucking industry. And I'm very much a proponent of you know, if you're the boss and you're responsible. That's the case in my business anyway. One of my employees screws up, but still, it's my problem. I think that in that subsection 10, if we took out "or employee" where it appears on line 20 in both instances, so that would read, an officer of a corporation or a member of a partnership who is responsible for exercising the duties of a corporation or partnership and who fails to pay taxes as required by this section may be held personally liable for payment of the taxes and for payment of any interest, penalty, or other changes due, or charges due, excuse me. I think that would answer the concerns that the industry has about reaching down into the employees of a corporation or partnership, while at the same time answering some of the concerns that were raised by Representative Krupp and Representative Walker. And I would float that out there as a conceptual amendment and see if that's anything that you're interested in entertaining.
Let me see if I can. What we would do is we take the dash ones, we would delete line 4 there so that we leave in the personal liability. And then in the section 10, you would eliminate employee on line 20 in both places.
Yes.
Everybody understand that?
Yes, we have a question.
So you need the first.
Yeah, we want somebody to cover the audit question. I know you want the audit.
Yeah, you still want lines 1 through 3 of the dash marks.
Right.
Kind of a lawyerly question, I guess. My only experience with a corporation that did this very thing and dissolved and reformed was that the previous corporate officer put the corporation in his wife's name as the principal corporate officer, and he became an employee. That would still be possible with your. Proposed amendment. It may not be a way a good way to get around this if we take that part. I know it's not the intent of the agency to get down in there and find the employees, but
Representative, if I may, Mr. Chair, the one thing about that, though, like in that particular situation where he had been the officer and then he became the employee and had his wife become the officer in the reformation of the corporation, that family is still going, would still end up being personally liable in that kind of situation. It would just be, you know, here, I'm gonna hand the hot dog to you instead of, you know. That's
kind of
life, I think, you know.
Is it Wilkins, do you have a comment or a question?
No, I think.
Any
Mr. Chairman, at times like this, it would be nice to have a legislative councilman in the committee, but since you're a defensive legislative councilman,
give us a pay for him.
Well,
can we call and get legislative counsel? No, I'm just kidding.
I just wanted to ask a basic question since I'm not an attorney. One of the reasons businesses are commonly advised to form as corporations is to shield themselves from individual liability.
Mm-hmm.
Corporation officers can be held liable under certain circumstances when quote-unquote corporate veil can be pierced. If you might explain when that can happen.
Corporation Law 101. The concept behind corporations is to shelter the shareholders and or owners of the corporation by forming the corporate veil. You can't pierce it if you can show they did really outrageous conduct within the corporation. The example is forming a dynamite company because you don't want to be responsible for your manufacturing system that might blow up. This probably, and again, I'm probably getting beyond the mind knowledge, this is probably one of those things that's going to be very difficult to pierce the corporate veil for non-payment of taxes unless you can show there was ongoing intentional conduct of collapsing corporations and forming other ones. But it's probably a difficult one to get to on the theory that they've intentionally done something.
Now, if we pass this, is that going to mean basically just like bail without, well, people still going to have to justify that we're going beyond?
Essentially what you're doing, if you pass this, it would be like income taxes and other things. You would be saying the corporation exists except for these activities, which we say the corporate officers are responsible for, and there are a list of things that the corporate officers are responsible for, and this would become one of those things. Well, if you're listening to this, I'm on the money.
Thank you. I support this amendment that Representative Cromwell is offering. I can't go with the dash one in its present form. Absolutely can't go there. The testimony of the trucking industry was they don't like it when people don't pay their taxes, and they abhor that. Well, that's true, but it happens. And it happens pretty frequently, and it's not to say that it won't happen again. I just think there needs to be some accountability here. If we don't get the diesel fuel tax, we're still left with the weight mile tax. We still need to address this problem, and if evasion is a problem, this is another way to get at that. And just kind of let these people off the hook. If they're a good trucker and they're paying their taxes, they shouldn't have a problem. But as Representative Crummell says, you know, the buck stops somewhere.
ODOT, do you guys have any problems with what we're talking about here? Is that, I mean, I know it's not exactly what you proposed, but is that acceptable? And Mr. Russell and Mr. McKellar, I assume you don't like it, but you've improved it a little bit from... Now we're getting into reason.
Yeah, wordsmithing here.
That's
true. I can throw out another suggestion is we leave lines 22-23 as they are and then just adopt the first part of the dash one, which adds
if the person did audit, that deals with the timeline.
Okay. Let me see if I can state the conceptual amendment and Representative Crumlin represented well. You tell me if it's correct. We adopt the dash ones, deleting line four from the dash one, which would then leave the personal liability in. Then after we've done that, we would then go back to the original bill and conceptually amend that to take out or employee in the two spots that appears in line 20. That do it. What do you want?
That would
and that's your amendment, Representative Trumbull?
That is. I wouldn't have, and I recognize that it starts getting into the wordsmithing. I wouldn't have an objection to adding with knowledge in there. Probably the best place to put that would be after on line 20 where it says, or a member of a partnership. Let's see.
Yeah, what I would suggest is I think that they're going to have a shot at this on the Senate side. That probably would be good language. I think that gets into a whole nother deep discussion that probably would require some conversation on that. I'm not sure I oppose that, but it might be best if we made this as simple as possible and got it out of here and let them look at it with their Representative Devil.
Then, yes, that's what
my amendment is. Would this be analogous under your experience with the situation with the corporation that doesn't pay payroll taxes that they do normally?
It's already covered that.
That would be analogous, yes. Everybody comfortable with the dash ones? Any objection to the dash? First thing is you have a motion to adopt the dash one for leading line four on the dash one. Any objection? Okay. Adopt the dash one. And then next we have a motion to conceptually amend the amended 2189 by deleting or employee in the two spots that appears on line 20. Any objection to that? Okay, we make that conceptual amendment.
Mr. Chair, I would move 2189 as amended by the dash one and conceptually amended before we do that.
Any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Devlin.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Crumlin.
Aye.
Representative Newman.
Aye.
Representative Logan.
Aye.
Representative Taylor.
Aye.
Representative Walker? Aye. Okay, House Bill 2189, having received the majority, is passed before the due pass recommendation.
Okay.
Representative Wells, I'd like to carry the bill. We'll open. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2644. Janet, you want to explain the bill very quickly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2644 would require the Department of Transportation and each county to place a sign identifying each urban growth boundary on arterial that would exempt interstate highways. The requirement would take effect for signs that need to be in place by the year 2005, December 2005. The bill specifies that the signs will be paid for by taxes enacted this legislative session. I'd like to direct your attention to the dash 1 amendment, which deletes how the signs will be paid for from the original bill and instead, the signs required by the Act will be paid for from the State Highway Fund, and that the Act only becomes operative if there's an increase enacted by this legislature or an increase that's adopted by the people after referral of an act passed this legislature. Mr. Chair, this bill does have a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee, and it has an effect on the Department of Transportation and local government. We have a fiscal that shows the Department of Transportation's estimated cost. We don't have a similar cost estimate for those counties. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Beck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also have
Ted Holland is going to join me today. Keep this quick. This was a bill that I introduced last session and went through this committee, and it passed and passed on the floor and didn't make it through the Senate. We didn't, it came late as it is again. The goal of the bill is to try to help Oregonians have a more familiarity with the concept of an urban growth boundary so that we have, we're more aware of, that we have something called urban growth boundaries and we have a better idea of where they are in communities all over the state. We talk about it a lot inside the building or inside planning circles, but the general public doesn't always know what we're talking about when we talk about urban growth boundaries. And I think if we have signs throughout Oregon on major arterials that say you're entering an urban growth boundary or leaving an urban growth boundary, over time this will help familiarize the public with this planning tool or term that we use to identify where urbanizable lands are and where farm and forest are. That's for the general purpose of the bill. Last session, the 1,000 Friends and the Home Builders supported it. I haven't gone out and drummed up letters from both of them this time, but I don't have any reason to think they're not supporting it this session. The counties and I have talked about some changes, some modifications that are still needed to the bill. We can either work on that in Ways and Means, or if it goes over to the Senate, we can work on it there. But specifically, the counties would like to see the signs on county roads limited to the four metropolitan planning organization areas. So rural communities would not be responsible, required to put up these signs. If there was a state highway going through a rural community, that the state would then be able to put a sign in areas where there's a state highway going through a rural community. But this would eliminate the need to do it in some in every little verge throughout the state where there is no state highway. So that is a modification that we're going to make in the next step of the process.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bill Penhollow, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. I concur with what Representative Peck has shared with you. We will work on that and see if we can't get those additional amendments made. There is one other slight amendment that I think is just a drafting question in line 20 of the bill, where it reads, signs required by Section 1, Subsection 1, shall be paid from the tax or fee, transportation-related projects, as described in the Constitution, which is the highway, the State Highway Fund. I think that is intended to be in Section 1 and applying to both ODOT and the counties. But there may be some drafting reason why it just applies to ODOT, but I think that is an issue that we need to check into.
And I will add, too, along with that, which I concur with that, I think that needed clarification. We can work. The Dash 1 amendments stipulate that this bill would not go into effect unless we enact new funding, gas tax funding, this session. So this, even if we pass the bill, this science wouldn't be required unless we had a new funding source out of the legislature for road funding. And that's what the Dash 1 amendment is primarily going to have.
Okay, come on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Beck, is that, are the Dash 1 amendment agreed to by the co-sponsors of the bill by any chance?
Well, I talked to Representative Montgomery about them. I think he was okay. I did not talk to Senator Shannon. So that's good
question. Chairman,
she probably...
I'm going to give him the fact that she's going to get a shot at this bill at some point anyway. Probably,
yeah.
So to be able to voice her views on those
issues. Maybe she knows the bill won't go anywhere if she has anything to do with the funding situation. I don't know.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Doug?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jones Plank, the Department of Transportation, have the opportunity to sit in for Mr. Doug Kendall today. I'll be brief. We've worked with Representative Beck on this bill, and we have no problem with it, and the amendments, as were discussed with the committee, sound fine to us, too. We'd be happy to work with Representative Beck and the county if the bill moves on.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Anybody else testify on this bill? Close the public hearing on House Bill 2644. Open a work session on House Bill 2644.
Mr. Chair.
Attorney Welch.
This bill was around last session. I opposed it. Evidently, I was in the minority if he got it out of that committee. I may be in the minority again, but I'm still opposing it. We're spending money we haven't even gotten yet. We haven't gotten that tax increase through here. Now we're already spending it. That sounds like home. The money spent for everything that's being harvested comes home. So I think this is the sign is we have enough signs out there cluttering up the countryside without this, so I won't be supporting it.
Jay Devlin, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to support it, also knowing that it's going on to Ways and Means Committee and that official committee.
That makes you feel better.
but also, I do think that there is an issue, and I mean, it may not be throughout Oregon, and it may be just in the Metropolitan Planning Organization areas, and maybe it's just in the Metropolitan area to a large extent. But inside this building, everybody, whether they were here or not, seems to know the history of land use planning in the state, even though Senate Bill 100 is only about 25 years, a little bit more than 25 years old. Our average citizen in the state really doesn't have so much of an idea what an urban growth boundary is or what the purpose of it is. And trying to raise the public's awareness about that issue, I think, is important, particularly for public dialogue about the issue, because obviously there are proponents and opponents of various portions of land use planning in this building. And so I think the greater that we raise public awareness, probably the better. So I'm going to move the dash one amendment.
Thank you. Again, Devlin moves the dash one amendment. Is there any objection to the dash one amendment?
Thank you.
Yes.
I think the problem that Mr. Kendall pointed out with the original bill is also a problem with the dash one amendment, as well as the policy choice. So it says signs required by section 1-1. And it's section 1-2 that has a county requirement.
Mm-hmm.
So the county requirement is accepted the way it's written. Looks like the county requirement would happen even if we paid for from the state either.
Mr. Chairman,
Dublin,
I would be glad to withdraw my earlier motion, modify my motion on the dash ones, including the provision adding a county provision relating to the potential increase in fees.
Yeah.
If we do that by simply taking out the one in the parentheses?
Well, Mr. Chair, I have a question, though, for either the department or for Mr. Penhall. Have you seen the dash one amendment?
Just got it.
Okay. Because it says the 1-1 will be paid for from the state highway fund, and that the county money isn't state highway fund money. It's first to them, so it's not for the highway fund. So it would only become operative under Section 4 for both if the transportation package does pass, so maybe the change doesn't need to be made in the back one.
So the intent, if I may, Chair, the intent of the bill is that the funding would not come into play, the fines would not be required until a new gas tax passed, and that would apply for county and state for both provisions.
Okay. And I think that's what Section 4 does, and it does it for
okay.
Us.
Okay.
So.
We can talk. We'll talk with Ledge Council if this
moves
forward.
Mr. Chair, the dash one amendment deletes. Okay. I'm okay.
I thought we could pick
Janet said the opinion that men's dash ones are great as they are, I guess.
I think so. I don't think it's the same problem that you brought up with the original bill.
So, Representative Devlin, you want to go back to the original motion to move the dash ones as they are?
Mr. Chairman, I remove the draft motion. Now I move the original dash
ones. Any objections to the original dash ones? Hearing none, dash ones are adopted.
Mr. Chairman, I move.
Mr. Chairman, can I be very informal here?
Be very informal.
Representative Beck.
Yes, sir.
Do you want it with a favorable recommendation, ways and means, or without?
Knowing that we don't have all the committee members here, and you need 6 votes to get out of this committee.
I'm not going to change my vote either way.
I've spoken to everybody. I don't want to talk to the victim.
You don't want to talk to
me. She's the only one.
I haven't talked to me.
When? On the floor.
Well, all right.
Mr. Chair, I hold great persuasion with Representative Walker. I'd be happy to lobby her on behalf of Representative
Chair. Regarding our process, with the chair, if I move it with favorable recommendation, that fails, will you entertain a motion without recommendation?
Representative Devlin, I suggest just making a motion. Let's run with this thing.
Yeah.
Okay. I agree.
Mr. Tim, I'll explain to Representative Beck later for safety. I move this to Ways and Means without recommendation.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Krupp.
I am in favor of this legislation. Of the courtesy to Representative Beck, I said I'd move this out, and I'm happy to. I might even vote for it on the floor, even though he never votes for anything I ever want in his committee.
That's true.
Mr. Chair, I did vote against this last time. I think there is something to be said for knowing where, educating ourselves on where the boundaries are. And for that reason, I will be pleased to move on.
Representative Walker.
Well, I'm disappointed that my colleague didn't come talk to me because I'm having a tough time with this bill. I'm going to vote to move it on, but you got to talk to me.
I didn't talk to everybody. Sorry, I'll talk to you.
I think it's kind of a lot of money for a feel-good thing. So, you need that. I'll be a yes vote today.
Appreciate it.
What I think we've got here is,
I only have one question. It's a very quick question. Do we have to pass a law so that ODOT can put up signs?
No.
We're just making them do this.
The reason why I ask is because when I did speak with Representative Becca Batchers, I said, you know, I think it'd be really neat, especially as you go into our cities, if we put our, you know, the population and the elevation and that sort of thing. I think that's always kind of intrigued. That's close to them. It intrigues me. I don't know how many other people are intrigued by it. But,
are we going somewhere with this?
Well, the reason why I was asking is because we would call them to do this UGB thing. But even if we don't pass, even if this bill doesn't pass, my point is that if we don't have to pass a law that they can put up signs, ODOT could take the initiative and the counties could take the initiative if they were so moved to, and they could put these signs up. Correct. That's my only point.
Yes.
I'd like to remind you, Mr. Chair, that the signs to most of my cities are run over and knocked down most of the time. They can put them up once.
We're really deviating. We've got a motion. I hope we're back on track with this one.
Yeah, I'd like to talk to the fiscal thing here. It looks like from the second biennium that were 2001 to 2003. So there's another increase. Does that mean we're going to have more roads in the state?
That's putting them up.
Does that mean?
Putting them up second, third,
Okay. You want to share the to lead today. Motion to move House Bill 2644 as amended to Ways and Means with no recommendation. Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Representative Hill.
No.
Representative Trump.
Aye.
Representative Crummell.
Aye.
Representative
Neiman. Aye.
Representative Representative Walker.
I live in the reservation.
Representative Wells.
No.
Well, that's going to be the committee.
House Bill.
Are you going to, did you vote?
Yeah. House Bill 2644, having received majority, is passed on to Ways and Means. Close the discussion on House Bill 2644. Open a public hearing on this.
Yes.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 2635.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill, you may remember, I remember it because we were in hearing room 50 in the basement and had the first of the hearing on House Bill 2635, who was in March 8th. The original bill would authorize the operation of trucks and semi-trailer combinations up to 75 feet in length if used in transportation of agricultural products. So we had the first part of the hearing and heard what quite a few of the problems that were reported by the especially Christmas tree growers and the shippers of Christmas trees. We also heard at that point from Greg Galpani explaining some history of the issue, and Representative Lehman was chairing that meeting also and gave instructions to the parties to go work something out in the meantime. And the Dash 3 amendments are the product of that large work group that met during that time, between the intervening time. To share the Dash 3 amendments replaced the original bill and required the Department of Transportation to develop a variance permit system which a person can obtain, under which a person can obtain a single permit to operate over-dimensioned vehicles on state highways and all local jurisdiction roads along a designated route. Requires the department to develop standard terms for the permits through consultation with local road authorities, and authorizes the department to contract with road authorities or private contractors for the permit distribution. The provisions do not apply to single trip permits, and would also require the department to issue all trip permits other than single trip permits. You have at your place an fiscal analysis of the Dash 3 amendment and the Dash 3 amendment also. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sean Miller and Greg Galpanti.
Mr. Chair.
Well, we're going to get just a clarifying question from Janet, if I may. And that is, the Dash 3 replace the bill and all the other Dash amendments. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
No, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I represent the Pacific Northwest Christmas Tree Association. I am here today in support of House Bill 2635 with the adoption of the Dash 3 amendment before you. Mr. Chair, Janet did give a good explanation of what occurred a month ago. We did consider the 75-foot exemption. That's what you heard a little bit over a month ago. And the underlying theme from that discussion was that, from the agricultural community at least, is that why this bill was needed was to break down the roadblock, no pun intended, of the current variance permit system and allow for a more efficient way for farmers to transport products to the market. I want to remind the committee that this is not a new issue. This is an old issue. And as Mr. Galpani described at the first and second hearing, I believe it was the second hearing, this issue has been debated for nearly 5 years. And absent the Dash 3 amendments we will discuss this morning, this bill almost passed last session. Almost unanimous votes in both the House and Senate, and it went through a conference committee. Unfortunately, this issue has not gone away and will not go away unless you take legislative action. Again, over a month ago, the overwhelming response from the committee was that come back with a solution. Since then, we've put together a work group and tried to develop, and we've worked vigorously to put together the Dash 3 amendments, which are before you today.
No,
yes.
I guess the quicker question is who's on and who's off of this agreement?
What we've done in those work that work group is we have, if you remember from the first hearing, Greg has stated that last session and this session, ODOT, State Police, and AAA, they called this bill the bill that kills.
Since then, we have changed that around into a more efficient way. Currently, ODOT, AAA, State Police are now supporting the amendment, along with the Agricultural Communities Farm Bureau.
Who's off of the bill, I guess?
The counties, right now, and you'll hear from the Association of Oregon Counties, we, during our work session, we invited all interested parties, including any county that wanted to attend. The Marion County and Clackamas County were the only counties representative in that discussion, even though everybody was invited. Since then, they have been a little reluctant to steer in any form of change. And for us, change is needed. Again, it's an old issue. And you'll hear from them today. As for Clackamas County, I think Mr. Delcani can respond to how they feel about this. As for Marion County, I've also talked with the chair, commissioner of the county, and the comments that might be conveyed today by the permit technician is representative and does not convey the overall message from the county in this position.
Well, in a nutshell, if I can understand what you've done, is you've not changed the ability of counties to regulate the roads. It's just a one-stop shop to get the permits now that they could have got by going to each individual county.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. The intent of the bill was to create a one-stop shop without taking the enforcement and regulatory authority away from the road authority. They could still say which trucks can drive on which roads, which the 75-foot bill basically said that they would have that authority. So we have taken that, left that authority in their hands. We need a mechanism for distribution of those permits at a more efficient way. That's what the Dash 3 amendments do.
Well, Pony, are you satisfied that that's what the Dash 3 do, and are you comfortable with the result?
Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, my name is Greg Delpani. I'm the Deputy Director of the Motor Carrier Division of ODOT. I think if I could, Mr. Chair, let me just speak to the crux of the problem as I see it this morning. We've got a pretty accurate rendition of the process we went through and the charge that you gave us. And I think as discussions continue, even just this morning, with my colleagues and friends that are working on this issue, it seems to me that the crux of the issue that remains is that some may reasonably argue that the authority of the county over roads for which they are responsible and liable may be arguably eroded by this amendment. And that's the crux of the issue. But as we dealt with the subject matter, it became pretty apparent to all parties that you've got to be able to break a tie. Some entity has to be in charge. And so what this bill purports to do is it assigns the lead responsibility to the Department of Transportation. It has references, and the intent is that what is conceived and what is constructed will be done in a collegial kind of way with appropriate consultation and involvement of the counties. And yet, it remains the case that the Department of Transportation retains the role of breaking the tie. The idea is that for the motor carrier industry and for the growers, they will have the ability to obtain a single permit, where heretofore they've had to perhaps obtain multiple permits, that they'll be confronted by a singular set of terms and conditions, where before there has been some difference. It's putting a common face, a single face, in front of the growers in the industry. And I think if I was to draw an analogy for you, you are all familiar with IRT and IFTA. That all derived from the 1991 federal legislation, the Intermodal Surface Transportation Efficiency Act, and the whole purpose and point of that federal legislation is to provide a uniform set of circumstances to the motor carrier industry so they could deal with a base state, a one-stop shopping format, and under a uniform set of circumstances. And that's what this amendment is attempting to achieve. And I think you're going to hear some reasonable concerns from reasonable people about the issue of erosion of authority. And I think therein lies a policy call. And so I would offer that for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to understand in terms of the Dash 3 amendments, the testimony says that the counties retain those restrictions on the roads. So, for example, a county could, a person who wanted to have a county, a truck longer than 75 feet, you'll get a permit, but the town could say, you can't travel on the one road to get you to where you need to go to pick up Christmas trees. So they have a permit, they just can't get there. Is that a fair approach of what might occur?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hill, I'll take you back to our last committee meeting, and we really bifurcated the issue. This bill was about access issues, but in all the testimony you heard, the testimony centered around service delivery problems. And so we said last time that we will do our best to allow access where access is warranted with due consideration for safety. We may not always be able to get to yes, but we're going to focus the work group's attention and efforts on the business of service delivery. And so the access issue will remain when in the estimation of the road authority, whether it be county or state, it is unsafe due to highway geometrics to allow a 75-foot truck-trailer combination to travel over a certain roadway. That will remain the case, even in the face of this amendment.
Just so I understand, in terms of what's 75 feet, I mean, is that a semi? Is it a semi with two or three?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hill, say a tractor-trailer combination with a 53-foot trailer.
That's a standard?
Common configuration and common carriage.
So what are we talking about? This bill would allow triples to go to a Christmas tree farm?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, this does not change which truck can drive on which roads as accordance to the county. What this does, though, is as they establish their maps and they say, for instance, on a particular road, a 75-foot truck can maneuver this road, a lot of times, and you'll hear from the growers of the last hearing, the problem that was having was they would have to call get a state permit, get a Marion County, and possibly get a Clackamas County. And so the service delivery, it was a huge problem to obtain. And the truckers a lot of times didn't know, as they came into the state, who to call, where to get the permit, and if they needed all three of those permits. And so as of this particular bill, doesn't take anything away from them being able to determine which trucks can drive on which roads. And that's the thing.
One more follow-up. On page 2, it allows the department to contract private parties on the road course to issue permits on behalf of the department. I remember the testimony that we had received on this bill previously, that is that the Christmas tree grower could be that person who could issue the permit. And is there going to be some training or, I can just sort of envision, hey, here's your permit, but you know, the road isn't approved and the driver showed up. You know, he has a permit. He thinks he has the right to be there because he has a permit in his hand. It was given to him by somebody. I'm just curious how we manage that process so that we don't get people who in good faith think they have it, but they don't.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hill, I think the illustration you're drawing upon was the example cited of a permit being available for pickup at the grower's location. And then the question followed, so it was safe for the vehicle to traverse the highway to get there, but they now somehow need a permit to safely exit. And that practice was not a common practice. It's not a practice that the State Department followed, and it was not a practice widely followed by counties. In essence, what we currently at the state level, and I believe it's the case at the county level, employ third-party contractors for disseminating, distributing permits, not necessarily crafting them. There's a difference between the authorization and the distribution. The distribution through the third parties is intended to provide a streamlined, more efficient distribution method of permits that are crafted by the road authority or authorities. And in all cases, the folks that are empowered by the state to serve as a third party do participate in a brief orientation in state offices on the appropriate manner and method to be engaged in that activity safely and responsibly.
But as a one follow-up to that, it would seem in terms of that what we're talking about here is probably not a lot of trips to a Christmas tree farm. It happens in a single period of time. Is there a provision in here in terms of that they can provide pilot vehicles to
you know, do for added safety that allows them to move from that location out to the regular trash station where they can then go without a permit, so that we allow this to occur, but in terms of areas where, for safety reasons, we say they must provide pilot vehicles to guide the trucks in and out of the location. And I'm not thinking that we're going to have an instance where, you know, there's 2,000 semis showing up a day in these locations, maybe one, maybe two, through the growing, as they're cutting the Christmas trees and shipping them, I don't know, in terms of the volume. There doesn't seem to be a lot of volumes in a very limited time period of time. We all know when Christmas is, so, you know, they're cutting trees, I think, in November to, you know, can't go really past the 25th, I don't think, you know. So I'm just curious in terms of if that has been incorporated and that can be part of this process here that allows it to occur and that we address the issue of safety.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hill, no, the bill does not incorporate that amount of specificity about terms and conditions that constitute safe passage. But what I think it does contain, it contains in Section 2, numbered paragraph number 2, where it speaks about the road authorities involved developing standards for the terms and conditions of those permits. And in my view, I believe that language is speaking to the development of what are the common practices and conditions that would constitute safe travel.
Chair, in your opinion, does that language allow for them to adopt this that would then allow them for this to occur in terms of these vehicles to go in and out if they deem, from a safety perspective, that there's some added requirements in terms of, like, a large load, long load, you know, pilot vehicles to ensure that accidents don't occur?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hill, yes, that is my opinion. The bill provides for that latitude.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree. This is a situation that has been brewing 5 years, and I remember being on one of the committees that looked at this early on, and it's really high time that we take care of this matter and get it resolved, and I'm glad to see an amendment coming forth to try to do that. I have not been contacted by my county. This is one of, Clackamas County is one of the chief areas where we have this Christmas tree traffic and where the original problem may have originated. Can you tell me, Mr. Galpani, is Clackamas County then, have they seen the amendments? Are they in agreement with them?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loken, I can tell you this. Yesterday afternoon, I spoke by telephone with Pam Gilmore in Clackamas County.
Yes, okay.
With particular reference to these amendments. He expressed to me approval on behalf of Clackamas with one suggested modification, and that would be a conceptual amendment in Section 2, Paragraph 3. Pam suggested that we might consider changing the language to say something like, the department shall contract with other road authorities who desire to so participate, along with other private contractors, to distribute permits under this section. That would make it clear that any county that wished to be involved and included in the process would necessarily be involved. No county would be excluded. And it gets to the issue of the erosion of authority that some might reasonably argue occurs from adoption of this bill. So with that clarification, Ken Gilmore expressed support for this amendment.
All right. Additional. I see, you know, safety is a big thing there. I see that in the letter here representing Sean Miller's testimony that the Oregon State Police are listed as supporting this. Just that they must feel that this matter of safety is being adequately addressed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loken, I also spoke by telephone with Sergeant Alan Hageman of the Oregon State Police. He has reviewed this amendment, and he has accepted that it adequately addresses safety. And he empowered me to say that while the State Police had originally opposed
House Bill 2635, they now withdraw that opposition, and they are in support of the amendment.
Thank you. That satisfies my
We're on the dash threes on page one, section two, subsection three, is it?
Mr. Chair, the suggestion made by Clackamas was change the language to say the department shall contract with other road authorities who desire to so participate along with other private contractors to distribute permits issued under this section. And his intention was that it then becomes the option of the county to participate or not.
And the department is okay with that change?
Yes.
Chair, I guess I'm confused because that would mean it wouldn't be a one-stop shop if a county did not choose to participate.
Mr. Chair, no. I think the premise would be the one-stop shop is the Department of Transportation, and you will either obtain your permit from us or you will obtain it from a designated third party. And if the permit happened to be for, say, Marion County, and Marion County had indicated a desire to participate, we would allow Marion County to be the point of contact. The default is the Department of Transportation.
If I understand this, counties are required to allow ODOT to be the dispensing agent for their permits. This would also require ODOT to let them in if they want to be a dispensing agent for permits.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct with one qualification. This bill is only creating that scenario for continuous trip permits as opposed to single trip permits.
One question I have is that there seems to be no fiscal for this. Is ODOT comfortable if they can do this process of collecting all these permit fees and dispensing to the counties as they collect them and not incur any additional expenses?
Mr. Chairman, you're correct. The fiscal that has been prepared, with the information we have today, is a no fiscal impact. And bear in mind that the bill says that there's going to be some consultation and some development of terms and conditions. And so not knowing what that amounts to, it's difficult to assess whether or not there'll be a fiscal impact. Under present circumstances, using our present third-party provider contracts, if that was to be the mechanism that survives, in essence, Oregon revised statutes, it's in 818-270, provide for a third party to be able to issue such permits and allow them to retain a $5 fee for having done so. That statute also says that there's no longer a fixed fee from the road jurisdiction for the issuance of that variance permit, but it gives us the flexibility to assess any fee up to $8. And so what we simply do with a third-party contractor is we allow them to collect a $7 fee, which they retain $5, and they forward $2 to the department. So in essence, I don't have an expense. It's a revenue reduction, perhaps, in an accounting fashion.
One question, and then there's a lot of questions. The last time we cut this short and didn't get to the county's issue at all, if you have some real pressing questions, these two gentlemen have to take them.
Very quickly. Mr. Smith, are the clients that you represent agreeable to consensual amendment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, yes.
Representative Kruppelin, you had a question? Do you need it now or do you want to wait for it?
I'm not Kruppelin, I don't have a question.
I said Kruppelin.
I thought you said
Trump.
God.
You know, that covers both issues. Okay, thank you very much. The next one I have, I think, Bill, you've got a bunch of county folks that you want to bring up one time. Great.
How long are you going away?
Is this our last one, Mr. Chair?
This is theoretically our last one. There is one other one there, but I don't think anybody's going to do anything with it, so... 2359, I don't believe anybody's doing anything.
lot. I hate it.
Mr. Chair, a member of the committee, for the record, my name is Ben Hollis, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. And with me today is Cynthia Schmidt, who is the transportation engineer for the Marion County Public Works Department. Rob Wilbanks, who's operation manager for Douglas County Department of Special Services. And behind me, who will take my chair when I finish here, is Roy Burns, Intergovernmental Affairs Director for Lane County. We come before you having had discussions on the Dash 3 Amendment. We do not have major concerns with the concept here, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and that is to minimize the paper shuffling in issuing permits to the trucking industry. We have established with the Department of Transportation a system with all counties for issuing single trip permits by agreement, a process that's in place now. And I think this is a good model for developing further cooperative arrangements with the Department of Transportation for issuing permits. Our concern, Mr. Chair, is at the bottom of page 2, section 4, and the transfer of authority that's contained in section 4. If you will follow with me just a moment, in that section it says that the issuance of a variance permit under 818-200, the Department of Transportation may, it restricts or it strikes road authorities, and the road authorities are the counties, the cities, and the State Department of Transportation, the authorities that have jurisdiction over their own individual roads. Our concern is that this transfers the responsibility for issuing these permits, with the exception of the single trip permit, but it includes permits that are involved in multiple trips, in continuous operation, seasonal permits, and other permits that have time limitations. It's transferring that responsibility from the county to the Department of Transportation without transferring any of the liability. We are still responsible for what happens on those county roads, safety-wise, as well as with the investment that the public has made in the improvement of those roads. So our concern, Mr. Chair, is with Section 4. And I would like to have you hear our testimony this morning and give this consideration. We feel that we could develop a system with ODOT, the one that would be beneficial to the industry. And I think by restoring Section 4 and making some other minor modifications in Sections 1, 2, and 3, this could be accomplished in the Dash 3 amendments. I'd like to turn now to Mr. Burns from Lane County, and if I might, Mr. Chair, have just a few minutes at the end of our presentation to come back and talk to you about changes that I think could accomplish our goal.
Chair Lehman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Roy Burns. I'm Intergovernmental Relations Director for Lane County, primarily employed by Public Works Department within Lane County. Lane County government, as with all local governments, exercises local authority over the road systems that we've acquired, that we've constructed, that we maintain on a routine basis. When we consider movement on our road system of oversized and or overweight vehicles, we are concerned about safety, of course. We're concerned about impact on the roads and bridges and the construction standards that we have within the system. We are also, of course, concerned about making sure that commerce does move efficiently. And we have operated a system and operated a permit system in cooperation with ODOT for an extensive period of time. Our concern is with Section 4 that basically transfers control and jurisdiction over our road system to the state. In attempting to work with any state agency, we feel it's important to have equal standing with the state agency, if we lose authority over our road system and grant to ODOT a final determination on what happens on our road system, we feel that negotiations may be extremely difficult, more difficult than they are today. We would urge you to seriously consider a transfer of responsibility without transferring accountability in this partnership arrangement. We cannot really support the transfer of responsibility without accountability. And we urge that you look to some amendments that would maintain basically the arrangement that we currently have in protecting our current road system. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Schmidt to speak to some issues in terms of the Marion County Public Works System.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cynthia Schmidt. I'm a transportation engineer and civil engineer with Marion County Public Works. I've been there for roughly 13 years, and I've been slowly developing and overseeing this various permit program that Marion County has in place for that whole time. And I want to make clear that I am here today speaking on behalf of the County Public Works Department. The Marion County Board of Commissioners has not yet adopted a formal position on the bill. They've not had an opportunity to hear it and adopt a formal position yet. And we did feel, though, that it was appropriate that I come and at least express from the implementation standpoint some of the concerns that the Public Works Department has. Being passed out to you is a letter that I will essentially follow the highlights of that as we go. I do want to point out a few concerns that we have, but I also have some suggestions that might alleviate some of the concerns that we have in some of the other counties that we would hope that there would be some consideration of. In general, we do, as Bill Penhollow mentioned, support the concept of a one-stop shop to have that option and that capability for industry, which is very important. And in fact, we have done quite a few things at Marion County that take us toward that end. Some of the issues that we have center around the fact that the local road authority's ability to have a variance permit program is essentially eliminated if we do not participate in this joint issuing one-stop shop. And our concern there isn't that we don't want to participate in that. Our concern is that it doesn't allow us to do anything other than that. And the particular segment of industry that has prompted this particular bill is less than 1% of the industry vehicles that we deal with on an annual basis. And we're very strongly of the opinion that to go to a one-stop shop solely isn't going to meet the needs of the other 90-some percent. They all have different needs. They're all varied, and they need to have as many options available to them to comply, and one-stop shop is one option. But we really feel that it would not be the sole option and should not be. We also have some concerns similar to Lane County in that we have a single agency that essentially can't dictate the terms and conditions under which those will be issued. And we also echo the sentiment that it has been difficult to come to agreement on some terms. So we're willing to participate certainly and want to see it succeed, but we feel it has to be done with some kind of equal footing in terms of what each individual jurisdiction's needs are for both safety and infrastructure advantage issues.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What are your suggestions? How do we get there?
Well, we'll jump right to them. The suggestions that we have would be to consider doing an incremental approach to this, working out some individual steps along the way that would get us to a better product in the end. We think that would allow us to meet the needs of industry, but without a lot of resistance from the many road authorities involved. And that would include enhancing permit options rather than replacing entire permit programs. I think that is the most important one from our perspective, and that is that Amendment-3 as proposed eliminate a road authority's ability to issue their own permits. They have to do it through the one-stop as a contractor to ODOT. And essentially, that does not meet all of industry's needs. It meets a small segment of industry, We want them to also have the option if all they need is to come to us to get something that we can service that need. Another suggestion I have is that if there be a mandate, that it be that all jurisdictions must participate in making their permits available at all other agencies and private vendors if private vendors are willing to do that. That's something we already do at Marion County. And I think that's very reasonable to expect. But that still allows the individual jurisdictions to develop their permit system as they need to. And I also think that we need to develop consistent language and variance permitting requirements. And that is touched on in the amendments, but again, it leaves a single agency in the position of saying what we will all agree to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm confused. If you can set all the standards for all your roads, you've got the authority. All we're talking about is who you pay the money to. Is that what we're dealing with here? I mean, is there a practical expression of where you lose your ability to say that this road has a weight limit on it, it has a length limitation on it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, we feel that Section 4 does impose that limit on counties, because if we move the road authority, which has historically been the authority of that agency to issue and control the movement of traffic on those roads and transfer it down to them. As I was saying earlier, I think what we want to do is improve the existing system of getting the permits to the industry. What I'm suggesting is that if we restore Section 4 and leave the authority of each jurisdiction and the liability of each jurisdiction with the road authority that has responsibility over that system. I'm not sure ODOT wants to take on an additional 27,000 miles of road responsibility statewide. That's the county road system. If we leave Section 4 as it is and then look at Section 2 and say that the Department of Transportation, in consultation with the other road authorities, shall develop a system of issuing variances that allows persons to obtain one permit with the ballot for every authority, then we could get there. As I said, we've done that under the single trip permit system. That's basically handled now by ODOT, but it is in contact and consultation with the county or county executive.
See, Mr. Bill, let's see if I understand the question. If, in fact, Marion County has a road between Sublimity and Mount Angel, if they determine that the shoulders have all washed out, it's got a lot of curves, and if they cannot run 75-foot trucks there, if we adopt this Dashley amendment and this bill, can Marion County say to ODOT, we don't want 75-foot trucks on that section of road?
Yes, Mr. Chair, they could.
And ODOT could not issue a permit under a one-stop shop concept to go on that road?
That's correct. And they then would issue a continuous trip permit to allow, and it's not just 75-foot loads, it's not just long loads, it's all variances. Heavy loads, wide loads, all of those are dealt with in this provision, and that's why we're concerned about relinquishing that authority. We have the responsibility to the public that travel on that county road. Let me use your example.
Wait, let me go again. But ODOT could not allow trucks to go on that road that Marion County has said.
Okay. Go ahead and comment, Rob. Go ahead. This is Rob. Rob Banks from Douglas County.
Mr. Chairman, that's one of our positions with this amendment. It does not clarify that ODOT would be under mandate to respect the county restriction of the road. If I could...
Let me do something real quickly, because I think this is a critical issue. I asked Greg Del Ponte if he could come up forward again. And I don't want to interrupt, but I think this is just really a nutshell what we're talking about here. Greg, under this scenario, can Marion County say, we don't want 75-foot trucks traveling on a road between Sublimity and Silverton. And if they said that under this bill, would ODOT have the ability to issue a permit for a truck to travel on that road despite what Marion County says?
Mr. Chair, I think I would respond by observing that the intention is clearly that the department is not going to undertake a liability that the county is telling us is not warranted on their road. But let me give you this scenario, which I think the bill is intended to address. A vehicle is making a single trip that's going to traverse two different counties, two different road authorities. And one road authority thinks that this particular movement requires two pilot cars, one in the front and one in behind. And the next road authority thinks that a single pilot car is sufficient. And the only thing that's changing on this section of road is you're crossing the county line. Which permit condition should be levied upon the motor carrier? Somebody's got to make a call. And I think ODOT is saying...
What I'm hearing you say is ODOT gets to make that call. If they say, we think that road can handle 75-foot truck, you can override Marion County's decision.
I think that is
the answer. The answer is yes.
Okay. That's the intention.
Mr. Chair, it also applies not only to multiple counties, but to exclusive movement on county roads within a county. But it could just apply just to a single road within a county. The county would then have to have ODOT issue that permit, and the conditions would be then the responsibility of ODOT.
Mr. Chair,
mm-hmm.
I guess that interpretation you just heard is not what I understood when the previous people were up, in terms of that the counties would still have all the authority in terms of the limitations on the road system. And what we were talking about was the one-stop permitting process, and that the permits that are let out would have all the requirements under that. And in fact, what I'm talking about is because this has expanded from Christmas trees to everything, because I'm now understanding this. This is not limited to our Christmas tree problem. The Christmas tree problem is the impetus for this, but this is everything. And I don't know how to draw this back, but as I'm looking at it, the only two things that are taken away from the counties is how Section 4 is crafted is to grant the permit and then establish seasonal other timing stations on a permit, but then any road authority may issue that. They clarify that subsection 2, and then in new subsection 3, everything else that's in the original statute, it still applies to a road authority. And then, but I think the critical language there is authorized, as written in May, for permits it is authorized to issue. And so the only road authority who's authorized to issue permits is the Department of Transportation, if I understand how that's crafted. So counties are no longer authorized to issue permits unless you, I think, read it that through contracting, then the counties would then be authorized to issue permits. Therefore, if they enter into the one-stop shop and issue permits, they could put any variances and any restrictions on the permit. Is that a correct reading?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, that is correct. That in Section 4, ODOT becomes the road authority. For not only its roads, but for all county roads and 46 except for the issuance of single-trip permits. And you'll note throughout Section 4 there that there are other references made to make this parallel to eliminating a road authority may to saying the department may make these determinations with regards to issuing a permit, with the exception of the single trip permit. It very clearly says that ODOT becomes the road authority for purposes of issuing all permits except single trip permits.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, original bill dealt only with agricultural products, and we seem to have moved away from that concept and setting up this one-stop permitting process now that all permits that Jack Hill is referring to. Is the economy not fair to deal just with the agriculture permits, or what happened here on this whole issue? Because it seems to be a concern you lost control of your roads to everyone who wants to travel and who need a permit. So how did we move away from this issue of the just agriculture and Christmas trees?
Well, I think as Ms. Smith was indicating, we were trying to develop a system that would apply to the toilet industry while answering the agricultural or the Christmas trees issue. And we feel that that can be accomplished, but it's ODOT in consultation with the counties developing this system similar to what we've done with the single trip permit, and develop a system that applies across the industry. And it should resolve the agricultural issue at the same time. Short of transferring the permit issuance authority to ODOT.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Chair. But let's not lose focus on the fact that the reason we're here is because the counties have not been working with the industry and this Christmas tree industry to work this out. So if you would just sit down with them and say, yeah, from November through December, we're going to work with you. Here it is. You know, we understand the safety issues here, pilot cars or whatever, as you traverse from point A to point B until they hit the where the trucks would normally be able to travel without permit, without any special variances. We wouldn't have this problem, but we're here because the counties have been unwilling or unable to come to some terms with the industry. And so let's not lose sight of that. And so I'm sort of,
Mr. Chair,
you're walking a hard place. Today's the deadline.
I recognize.
And you're asking us to, you know, think and consider and move forward. And by being so reasonable and thoughtful, the bill's dead. So, how can we meet both goals?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, I would want to clarify one point. I don't believe that the counties have necessarily been the sole problem in this issue. Following the last session, it was agreed that the Motor Carrier Advisory Committee would explore this issue during the interim, would have regional meetings around the state, meet with industry, meet with counties, and define what the problem was and develop a solution to the problem. The Motor Carrier Advisory Committee, under the direction of Mr. Del Ponte, did that, had the regional meetings. We had county people at every meeting ready to sit down and define what the problem was and see if we couldn't work out a solution. Unfortunately, the industry didn't show up. And so, from that, we made the wrong assumption that there wasn't a major problem out there and went on about our busy schedules, only to come back this session to find legislation again before us on the Christmas tree issue and the 75-foot issue, and now it's evolved into not only those issues, but all permit issues. So I recognize the situation. I think that we do need a bill. My suggestion would be, as I've indicated earlier, restore Section 4. Go to Section 2 and basically give ODOT the responsibility in working with us to develop a system. They have that charge. We will cooperate with them. In subsection 2 of Section 2 say that in consultation with the road authorities, they shall develop the standards for terms and conditions of the permit. Subsection 3, the department... in subsection 2, the standards, what we would want to add is the standards shall be applicable throughout the state. recognizing regional and geographic differences of the state, because we do have varying road condition differences throughout the state. And subsection 3 of that section 2, basically, again, the language that was suggested by Mr. Gilmore.
I think that would accomplish the task. It would be legislative direction to the department and to the counties and to the cities to develop this, and it would leave vested with those jurisdictions the responsibility for issuing permits over their own systems, but in a cooperative way with ODOT and with the industry.
Mr. Chair, I guess to get us out of here today or something, perhaps we take the Dash 3 amendment and add a subsection of, a section in front of it all that restricts the whole purpose simply to the agricultural product, put a sunset on it, shove it over to the Senate, and tell these people to continue working and work out what we're talking about here. But I think in terms of what you're suggesting, still doesn't get what the industry wants, is because you're still not at the table, and any solution is at hand in terms of, if we'll get together and we'll work, well, that was the expectation. And I understand what you say, industry didn't show up at the table, but we're still here at this problem. That may, we can narrowly do it. We can, I think, in good faith move forward on the issue on the House floor, and it's reasonable that the approach that has been adopted here is narrowly drawn only to agricultural products and not everything else, which would continue the bill to move forward. It doesn't take a huge swath out of the county, and we can continue to work the issue.
Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you say then, Mr. Penhollow, that the concerns of the counties were ignored in the drafting either of the Dash 3 or of the bill or in the issue?
Mr. Chair, to try to give full credit to all discussion, maybe not understood, maybe not clearly communicated, and we received these amendments late yesterday afternoon. I had the opportunity to fax those out to several people. It still had the concerns in it that we had expressed earlier about the transfer of this authority. So, but we haven't made that clearly enough in the discussions, or whether it has been ignored, I can't make a judgment on that. But it hasn't been addressed in the Dash 3 amendment.
Mr. Chair, do you have, other than just restoring Section 4, do you have other specific language that you were ready to propose?
Yes.
Okay. I find it, one comment, Mr. Chair, I find it interesting that when the industry sitting at the table said that the county is ignoring except for Clackamas, which is one of the largest Christmas tree growing counties in the world, and Marion County were the only two that showed up, that Mr. Penhollow is telling us that they went to each of the regional meetings. And so somebody's not telling us the whole side of the story, I guess. I don't know. But I would agree with what Representative Hill is talking about, would be to add language that would apply to the agricultural industry.
Let's move backwards a little bit. Showing a positive, this, we're getting better than what we've had in past bill with these attempts to do this, if I understand correctly. We're better off than we were last session, and we're probably better off than existing law in some regards. Is everybody in agreement that a one-stop permitting process in terms of issuing, ODOT issuing permits that Marion County can issue, and Marion County issuing permits that Clackamas County could issue, a one-stop permit is fine as long as you're issuing permits that the other county would issue? That concept is okay.
I'm sure it is, including a private sector issuance of permits under certain circumstances.
circumstances. But I would like in both Marion County and Douglas County to respond to that. They're on that now.
And if I also understand correctly, I'm just trying to build this up to a point where we're agreeing and disagreeing. If I understand, that's okay with the user group. That the first question is getting the right to a permit one place, one time, and not have to stop six different times or go to six different places. The problem occurs is as Mr. Valpati said, is at some point you have to break the tie, and somebody has to decide whether the truck going from Clackamas County to Marion County can go through there, and that's when you start getting a disagreement when ODOT is breaking the tie and saying we're going to issue this permit to go through two different counties under one set of conditions. Am I saying the problem correctly?
Mr. Chairman, if I may. That's exactly the point of Douglas County. We are locally responsible for the maintenance and the building and the safety of our county roadway, not ODOT. I would doubt that ODOT would want to accept that liability for issuing permits outside of the restrictions that Douglas County places on its own roadway, not knowing what the conditions at that time of the roadway are, what the traffic patterns are, what maintenance might be underway, what temporary restrictions might exist. We have, in Douglas County alone, 1,100 miles of paved roads, 300 bridges. A number of those are weight restricted. You multiply that by 36 counties, without going on, I think my point's clear. It's overwhelming to think that ODOT could be responsible for each and every roadway and every circumstance that might arise. I can do that on a local basis. I can address each of my specific problems in my county when that specific caller comes to me and explains what he needs. In Douglas County, we do address the needs of each applicant.
Okay. No objection. Here's what I'm going to do. We got one other bill, and this is all maybe coming together for the right reason. We got one other bill. You need to hear quickly. What I'm going to do is I'm going to close the public hearing on this for about 10 minutes and give you guys the opportunity to go in the hall with the knowledge that we're going to come back in here and probably at 5 to 11, we're going to do something with this bill. It's either going to be something like kill it, which the users aren't going to like, or something like pass it, which the counties aren't going to like. And I get the, feeling that there's ability to find common ground. So I'm going to, give you about 10 more minutes to see if you can in the hallway come up with something that one of you doesn't walk out of here totally unhappy with. And moving on to the Senate, which has been described as the dysfunctional committee in this body, and see if they can make this thing any better or worse. So is that okay with the committee? We'll hear the last bill we've got set up here in the next 5-10 minutes and bring you guys back in at 5 to 11. We're going to do something with this thing. And, so I certainly hope that you can come together with some agreement. So close the public hearing on House Bill 2635. And I'm going to open a public hearing on 2359. Representative Zansky, you've heard the instruction, so you have a short leash on this bill. Janet, you want to explain this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2359 would disallow the Department of Transportation from issuing or renewing a driver's license to a person who has not paid a local or state parking ticket as reported to the department by either a state agency or a local government. It authorizes any agency or political subdivision to report unsatisfied judgments for parking violations to the department and requires the jurisdiction to report when payments of such judgments are made, and they have to report the payments within 7 days. Requires the department to notify drivers prior to their renewal that they do have unsatisfied judgments on their records with the department. They also have to state the nature and the date of the violation, in that notice to the driver. This is to let the driver know why they may not be renewed. Allows the person to request an administrative review of the record and authorizes additional fees at issuance or renewal for processing such unsatisfied judgments. This is not mandatory on the local government to use DMV in this way, but it's mandatory on DMV if they do get records from local government to refuse to issue or renew. It's set by the operative date of July 1st, 2000. And we did get a fiscal statement from the Department of Transportation, and it was substantial. And I don't know if our event presenter got that because we just kind of just
I don't know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair. Wells.
I have two questions. First, have we had this issue before the legislature before in this form?
For the record, Roy Pradonsky, House District 40 representative. Mr. Chair, Representative Wells, yes, last session I brought the same or similar legislation, I think it may be basically the same, that we heard the judiciary.
That's what I thought. I've seen this bill before. And then we dealt in judiciary with a bill that allowed cities to turn outstanding fines over to collection agencies.
Absolutely.
And I was wondering if the cities are making headway on collecting all these outstanding fines that have built up through the years through the use of, increased collection efforts.
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative Wells, I cannot answer that question. I guess what I'd like to do is just give a very brief history as to why this bill came forward and why I'm bringing it back again. First of all, there are a number of courts in this state, justice courts or municipal courts, that have issued and have actually had judgments entered against individuals in their jurisdictions. City of Eugene had $1 million backlog. City of Portland had $4 million backlog. Previously, my thought is that I believe that the state and the local government should be working in a partnership. This is a means to allow for that to occur because there is money that comes into the state from the part of the collections that occur from different type of fines that have been imposed by the local municipality, including justice court. And I guess this is my conservative philosophy, as it may not seem possible, but it is my conservative philosophy that we should not be engaging in basically having the money that belongs to the entities, the governmental entities, to be basically cashed out through a private entity, i.e. a collection agency. There are different arrangements, and I forget the last bill that we did in 97, it actually had a cap as to the amount that could be entered into by the private entity for collection on the debt. To me, the reality is that this is money that's being assessed as penalties, and that it should stay within the workings of the state, the cities, and the counties. And this is just, I think, is an approach that would, in fact, allow for that partnership to continue to work on a better course, because the reality, the catch here, is that no one's going to get their license renewed if they have outstanding parking other type of violations, judgments pending in any of these courts. If the local court or local municipality has actually given notice to the Department of Transportation that they're outstanding, and they do want them to be red flagged for their license purposes. So that's what the bill is.
You foresee any problem with parking tickets because you have different people driving a vehicle and they incur parking tickets, like just 12 times a day, that it ends up being a lien or a judgment against the owner of the vehicle as compared to the person actually driving?
Well, that's the way it actually is now. I mean, the reality is that those tickets, it's almost like I would call strict liability. Your vehicle is going to be tagged for a standing parking violation. Then it is assumed that since the car is registered to you, that you are the one that's going to be faced with it, and that you would have a duty to, let's say, make any collections from whoever was maybe borrowing or using your car. Of course, if it was parked illegally, unauthorized, I would assume that there'd been a report of that my car has been stolen, etc. So this is an idea that I still think it has merit, and I'm sorry to the Mr. Chair, Representative Wells, and I cannot give you what the current status is, but it struck me that when you have these type of outstanding debts, that that's money that could actually stay in-house or stay within our governmental structure instead of having a profit being made on the collection. Not saying it's the only way to do it, but I think given the opportunity, you would see the cities and the counties utilizing this approach over the other, which would in fact return more money into the city, county, and state coffers than to a collection agency.
Is that well, is there a question?
Yes, I guess. Look at the system. There's going to be a $15 service charge that DMV will collect. How is the money flow handled here? You're going to basically put pressure on drivers then to go in and pay their fines. That would go then to the local entities. How does that money end up then at the Department of Transportation?
Okay, there's two different fees here that would be paid. I should say debt that would fine and fee is the best way to do it. Mr. Chair, Representative Wells, the debt is the fine that has already been incurred. That would the red flag would require the driver of the vehicle who got the citation, who had the judgment already entered against them, to go back to that local jurisdiction and pay those outstanding fees. Now, whatever those costs were, there already is a mechanism that a portion of that money is divvied up through the collections and some of it goes to the city or the county, whichever jurisdiction it is. A portion of that also goes into the state general fund.
Mm-hmm.
So that's that money. Then what would happen, because the person's driver's license privileges have been red flagged, when it was cleared by the city, they would have to then pay this other cost, which is supposed to help offset the cost of the physical impact. And that's why, without seeing the physical before 3 minutes ago, it's hard for me to see exactly if that has been included to the offset for the cost of the program. What we attempted to do is make it as revenue neutral as we could.
Where does the $15, which $15 come from? That's a service charge that would, on addition to the fine, then that the person pays, or
that is
out of the city's money?
That's correct, because what happens now is when your license is suspended by the Department of Motor Vehicles, and if it's suspended because you fail to comply with a court order, i.e. pay your fine, you'd have to go clear the fine, and then because you got the suspension that's been placed on your license, you'd have to come in and you'd have to pay that fee to get it reinstated. And it's working on the same basis as that. Even though there wouldn't be, quote unquote, a suspension in place because of the red, let's call it the red flagging of the person's license, that this would be an offset for their administrative cost. And so, again, I can't comment on the fiscal as to whether or not the money that would be coming in on this has been taken into consideration. And I guess my review of it, I don't see any mention of that. So I believe that the fiscal that's before us would actually be offset by the collection on these individuals. Now, I understand that this would require it to go down to Ways and Means. So I didn't expect it to not to be reviewed by them, but I would ask me to consider referring this to Ways and Means for their consideration.
Well, as I understand, the $15 fee, I'm looking here on page 2 of the fiscal, DMV would charge the respective jurisdictions. So, preparing the judgment and passing out outstanding fines and penalties, let's see.
No, Mr. Chair, I don't think that comes from the jurisdiction.
It says penalties, passing the outstanding fines and penalties to the respective jurisdiction. It says we'll charge a $15 fee for clearing.
I understood that that was still charged to the driver.
That's my understanding. That's the intent.
So then the jurisdictions then will be adding an additional $15 onto the fine when they pay it?
I don't believe that's correct. I believe that when they came in to the Department of Transportation, that's where it would be paid. Either way, if it was going, let's say, back to the jurisdiction to be collected, then it would be passed on to...
Well, where are these fines paid? If they're putting pressure on...
The fines if I could, Mr. Chair, Representative Wells, the fines themselves would be paid at the jurisdiction that has given notice to the Department of Transportation that they're outstanding. So, in other words, the driver would go down to their local DMV, they get this, well, it'd be one of two ways. They would get a notice saying that their license is coming due, and there could be a notice with that license, renewal notice saying that these are outstanding, they have outstanding fines in the various jurisdictions that have red flagged them. Or that they, when they went in, there's two ways that it was discussed that it would be, the notice would be given to the driver. But the driver would have to go back to the actual jurisdiction on their own to clear them, and that is to basically hold them accountable and responsible for them not taking care of the debt previously, and also that it would keep the cost between the agencies down. Once that has been completed and they've paid that, the notice can come from the local jurisdiction to DMV, basically removing the red flag, and then at that point they've done.
Ms. Walker, do you have a question you want to answer?
No, that answer. Thank you.
Representative Johnson, that's...
I understand the process, yeah. Before I go ahead, I don't understand how this all going to show you.
One of the problems Kelly Cater was here and was going to testify, but she had to leave, and we got this in the last possible moment, so I'll close the public hearing on 2359. What's the tweeting going to do? Do you want to move it to Ways and Means, let this thing lay here, or what?
Mr. Chair, I'm in favor of the concept. I think we need to have some further discussions on it, but I'm more than happy to move it to Ways and Means.
I think we ought to let it go. I'm not comfortable. I don't understand the concept of how all this is going to flow yet.
For the last moment, so I'll take that as a motion to move this bill. I'll open this question on House Bill 2359. Representative Cup, do you have a motion?
Yes. I move, Mr. Chair, that we move House Bill 2359 to Ways and Means with no recommendation.
Representative Hill.
I don't know what I'll necessarily do with that. Not listening. Another suggestion might be to send it to Rules, where we could still have some policy discussion prior to going down to Ways and Means. Sometimes the rules can keep it alive, and you have the policy issue continued, so we can at least try to remain semi-pure that Ways and Means doesn't do policy.
I was saying, two thoughts. One is that I would think we've got a lot of bills going to end up going to rules, and the second thing I would suggest, my theory is that the concept of collecting money is a good one. The only question I have is whether it's worth the financial cost. The fiscal impact of doing it. Everybody out there, your parking tickets for giving up cities and counties are great. It's just whether it's going to be worth the money to do it or not.
Policy decisions partly, and it's a Ways and Means decision partly. I think we have to have accurate Ways and Means.
Do you want to say what the motion?
This will eventually work its way to the Senate, correct? Assuming it passes the House floor after Ways?
Yes.
I'm not sure where
it is. Mr. Chair, I'm going to withdraw my motion and amend and make a motion that we send it to Rules. I just feel better about sending a better bill, more thought out, debated, over to the Senate side. I just think it's a better way to go.
Representative Cup has moved this move with or without recommendation?
Without recommendation to Rules.
Representative Cup moves House Bill 2359 to Rules with no recommendation. Through further discussion.
I just got one question.
Same comment.
I noticed that the staff person from League of Oregon Cities was here but didn't say anything. I'm just curious as to whether the League has any kind of a position on this or if they're just watching with interest.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummel, what the League staff person did before sitting here was try to find the League staff person who is a lawyer and is dealing with the and as once before I testified before this committee, I
was glad when I changed my major from economics. I also was glad when I made the decision after taking the LSATs and getting accepted to law school not to go there. But I think, you know, in all seriousness, I think that any additional tools that can enable local governments to collect judgments or the fines, which there are many millions of dollars when you have the other cities outstanding, you know, and also the deterrent effect that it has when people know that their license renewal or registration renewal might be dependent upon that, we think is a valuable tool, and it's just another way to make sure that people can comply. So I think it's something we fully support and appreciate keeping the line. Thank you.
Okay, no further discussion. Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Devlin.
Aye.
Representative Hill.
Aye.
Representative Crummell.
Aye.
Representative Lehman.
Aye.
Representative Taylor.
Aye.
Representative Walker.
Aye.
Yes.
Up to 2359, having
well, would like to vote.
Brad!
My!
Aye.
Up to 2359, having received a majority of the votes, is moved to House Rules with no recommendation. Close the work session on House Bill 2359. And open a work session on House Bill 2635. Do we have a deal? Representative Dale Oliphant, we have a new player in these negotiations.
I just went out of the hall and sometimes
got to based on the Christmas tree going in your district?
That's right. That's it. I like Christmas. Christmas is fun. I think in terms of counties would be okay. There's still issues that they can work out. And the willing to go work out, I think, in terms of the relatively close. The agreement was to remove Section 4 of the Dash 3, adopt then the Dash 3's move forward. They'd work out the fine details in terms of how the interplay between ODOT and counties would be for issuing variances on trip permits that override local road authorities, and there's some discussion out there in terms of how that should occur. I think they will come to some agreement on it. We move forward on the issue, it's alive, and I think they're very close.
So if I heard you correctly, you're moving
a conceptual amendment to the Dash 3 to remove Section 4 of the Dash 3 amendment.
And do we also want to still add the language in Section 2, Subsection 3, or just leave that as it is?
I think if we just go and they can deal with it.
So the conceptual amendment is on the Dash 3 to eliminate Section 4 of the Dash 3. Any objection?
Discussion, or objection, maybe. I'm not sure. But I want to be sure that my county is going to be satisfied if we do not have that conceptual language. Was that discussed?
Counties are dealing in good faith in terms of the competent approach that I think all counties will be able to work with.
Uh-huh.
In terms of, I don't think that's an issue.
Bill Fondi, you're nodding your head back there. You think Clackamas County will be okay with that?
That's your question of the resolution? Well, we do not have to have that conceptual language then to satisfy Clackamas County.
A couple of conversations, and especially our last-minute conversation in the hallway, I think he can be satisfied that the parties are moving ahead to the jury.
All right. Then I'm okay.
Okay.
I just want to point out, since it is a conceptual amendment, and council, there may be some internal inconsistencies that council has to worry about, but we will have to deal with that.
I would see the conceptual amendment sent to the floor if we've got a problem.
Is this committee going to be made a rule?
Who knows? Any objections to the conceptual amendments to the Dash 3? Hearing none, we adopt the conceptual amendments to the Dash 3. Representative Hill.
I move the amended Dash 3 into House Bill 2635.
Any objections to the amended Dash 3 being adopted? Hearing none, the amended Dash 3 is adopted. Representative Hill.
Move House Bill 2635 as consistently amended to the floor. Mr. Pass recommendation.
Clerk, call the roll.
Representative
Aye.
Representative Hill.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Cohen.
Aye.
Representative Weeman.
Aye.
Representative Logan.
Aye.
Representative Kidd.
Aye.
Representative Walker.
Aye.
Representative Wells.
Yes.
House Bill 2635 is having a huge majority of the vote is, is moved to force a due pass recommendation, closed work session on House Bill 2635. I know there's people signed up on here that you didn't get to testify, but I assume we, I know, the Christmas tree guard, I assume we've solved your problems and, we're okay with that so far. Okay. Anybody screaming? Representative Hill, you want to carry this bill?
I'm more than happy to. I like Christmas.
Close committee.